Hey, I'm Rahul Raj, founder of Five and Vine. Five and Vine is a challenger brand agency. We help challenger brands take on and take down industry incumbents.
Things are changing, but I believe there's a version of Canada that is about caring deeply about how we win.
Yeah.
And how we win includes who's present, right? So can we create an environment socially and economically enabling everyone to win here, because mm-hmm. when we welcome people in, we enable them to capitalize on all of their competencies that we valued in the first place.
Right.
So I think that's one aspect of Canada. I think a second is understanding that there's tremendous amount of value in diversity. I think the opportunity for Canada going forward is to demonstrate that winning isn't everything. It's about how you win.
Founded in 2017, Startwell is Toronto's independent hub for innovators to collaborate. Our podcasts relate perspectives from the world's most diverse urban population to reflect unique insights into global business, media, and culture.
Rahul Raj, welcome.
Thanks, man. I'm stoked to be here.
Startwell Podcast Studio. It's great because you've been here but many years ago.
A long time. Yeah, and it's amazing to see the evolution.
Thank you. And a lot's changed since then outside of our door.
Just a couple things.
I wanted to talk to you for a number of reasons today. Our audience has been asking for more content that's expressive of the current marketing climate and that offers perspectives that they can bring into their own companies and in their marketing practices. So there's a little bit of that. And then also, of course, for anyone who has just tuned in and is unfamiliar with your work, Five and Vine is the name of your agency. And what I thought was really cool about your perspective on the way that you approach your work is you work with companies that are challenger brands. So I want to dig into what that is, because I think that's going to be something that's far more of a pertinent phrase and concept for people to rationalize as the economy continues to be a little bit fair game for the next few years.
Yeah. So I think that there's a baseline definition of challenger.
Yeah.
And that baseline is where you're not the number one in the industry.
Right.
Where you're essentially challenging the incumbent and trying to displace them for market share. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the simplest version of the definition. Our version is a little bit different. And it's based on the ability to challenge the economic model and the incumbency of those organizations by saying this isn't just about capital alone.
Yeah.
You know, capitalism needs to be evolved. We displace too much or externalize too much cost on society.
Mm-hmm.
And we just say, well, that's the government's job, or that's an NGO's job, or that's a local politician's job. It's like, this is not a sustainable model.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways that you can deliver economics and social good simultaneously. So that's the baseline version.
Okay.
Then there's a slight evolution, which also says we don't just buy shit. We're buying identity. We're buying a badge that sort of signals to others.
Right.
We might believe in the same thing. Right. Maybe we can be part of the same community. And so our version of challenger also includes that you're buying more than a product or service.
Yeah.
You are engaging with something that is a reflection of your values and that connects you to other humans.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it is about challenging the traditional view of capitalism to deliver something good,
yeah,
and helping people connect with other people.
It's so interesting because I think we are at a time where, you know, spending power needs to be questioned in terms of often cases. Okay, like on the meta, we can kind of get philosophical about it and say that, you know, most people's spending power in middle class Canada, specifically here, is borrowed money regardless. And so what does that mean, you know? Whose mandate are you fulfilling by being an active consumer? And if you don't own that identity, just as a starting line, every purchase you make is going to fulfill the wants of advertisers in some way. And of course, with digital media, we've been seeing this for the last decade, where the, you know, algos are driving consumer behavior to a certain degree by relying on impulse. We started before we pressed record talking a little bit about this like social media landscape and how crowded it's become. And now a generation has been raised on social media. So, you know, it's interesting to consider that generation growing up. And what are your thoughts on this kind of idea of like the crowded digital landscape, which has been funded by advertising, you know, affecting perceptions, market perceptions, consumer perceptions of how they can spend and what they spend on?
Yeah, it's complicated.
It is.
To say the very least. But to make it simple, I think if we bring it down to a human level.
Yeah.
Like, we all need some form of money to survive, right? To buy food, to buy clothes, to pay rent. If you're in a privileged position where your base needs are met, you can choose to engage in something that's more meaningful.
Right.
But if those options aren't available to you, you still need to eat, right? You need to find something. And so whether or not you agree with the political ideology of McDonald's, if they're paying you, you know, minimum wage to flip burgers, you do what you got to do.
Right. Or if you're hungry and you're walking by a McDonald's, you might dip in.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so I think what's interesting about the way that most businesses are run, particularly ones that are venture backed or private equity backed in some way.
Yeah.
It's like, what is the mandate you're solving for?
Right.
If it's money, is it money at all cost, or is it that you care about how you make the money and you care about making money?
Yeah.
And I think that's representative of what's happening in the relationship between advertisers and sort of and the social media audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, is their mandate just to make money? And if that's it, then if you're, you know, you have advertising on your podcast, you're like, I'll take any advertisement that's available to me. But if you are a values-driven podcaster...
Storyblocks.com.
Exactly, exactly. But if, you know, you have a value set that says, no, this is what we believe in, and so we only want advertisers that align with that ideology,
yeah,
right, or align with those values, it creates a different subset. And so I think it's just a matter of what are we trying to optimize for?
Totally. Yeah, and it's very interesting because I think, you know, like... Of course, our customer profile here at Startwell is every type of organization, right? From early stage startups, they might be funded, they might be bootstrapped, to large enterprises. And I think this idea of kind of, at least in Canada, we've gone from a very values-based, perhaps, economy in the 90s, it feels like, into chaos in the last decade where monopolies have kind of, you know, maybe not out of some Machiavellian kind of construction, but like, you know, have dominated industries for so long that consumer behavior has been affected and their perceptions of what's possible to buy has been, you know, affected. And I'm seeing that in the young enterprise area, or I guess new startups world, where companies are being formed to mimic monopolistic companies. Yeah. Like the ultimate outcome is, yeah, there might be some sort of like, you know, cash flow gain. It's like, we're going to have a win. Payday when we go IPO and everyone's getting paid out. The pyramid scheme's going to work, guys. You know, there's that. But then there's also this kind of like, well, it's not worth doing unless it's big enough to own the market. And definitely I've seen just in the last few years, post-pandemic, it could be this like return to analog, you know, vibes. But people who are starting companies saying, wait, maybe there's no negativity that I should assume around the lifestyle business, around creating something that is sustainable, that can pay for me and my employees, that can develop relationships and express value for our customers. And what the growth story is, well, I don't need to pre-calculate that. As long as it's sustainable, I can figure that out as I go.
It's a fascinating one, right? I don't know that the continuum, the bookends of the continuum are necessarily unicorn or lifestyle.
Right, right.
Right. There's a massive set of possibilities along that continuum.
Yeah.
I do think, though, there's an over-romanticization of more.
Yeah.
And not enough regard for enough. So do you necessarily need to be a $10 billion or $100 billion company or a $1 trillion company? Or can you identify a point along the continuum that works?
Right.
right? That is more than enough for everyone involved in the organization,
mm-hmm.
and still allows you to live your values, whatever those happen to be, so that you're not taking on any client, any advertiser, any customer. It's about fit more so than it is about come one, come all.
Yeah. So your agency is focused on Canadian clients,
yeah, so
or all over the place?
A third in Europe, a third in the US, and a third in Canada.
Okay.
Which has been so extraordinary.
And is that by design or by happenstance?
Happenstance. Okay. Yeah, I wish I could say that I was a magician at these things.
Yeah.
I am not. You know, it's a personal network and reputation that has enabled our growth more so than strategy.
Are there differences between those, you know, clients that you can kind of say? They might be across different industries, so that this might be a hard thing to answer for. But cultural values maybe as companies and how they fit into the larger kind of cultural milieu of their economies in different countries.
100%. There's a meaningful difference across the geographies. I would say that American clients are some of the most interesting in the sense that their competitive set is big and bold.
Right.
And so their willingness to be big and bold in response or to take a true challenger strategy where you're identifying where is that, where is our competitor letting their customer down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is there an opportunity to address the pain points that people tolerate? Like, for example, a Rogers cell phone plan that is unnecessarily expensive. Right. It just makes no sense. It's another one of those monopolistic characteristics that you were talking about.
Right. We pay on average, I think, 3x what an American would pay for cell phone coverage.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's tolerated. It should not be allowed. And it's frustrating as fuck.
Yeah.
But putting that aside, the American clients are much more bold and they have a willingness to take risk. I would say that in Europe, it's very relational, but in the most charming of ways, where you can take risk, but only after you spend time breaking bread with the client, establishing a trusted relationship, and then there's a willingness to take risk.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that that contrasts differently with the American clients, which is the relationship to some extent is important, but it's really about what are people outside the company doing? And then Canada is just a little bit more safe, right? And there's a perhaps a higher level of conscientiousness around the potential legal risk.
Right.
So whereas in the States, perhaps asking for forgiveness is the right way to go, I think in Canada there tends to skew a bit more towards getting that permission right out the gate.
Mm-hmm. In terms of issues of libel and stuff like that.
That's right. So because often challenging requires you to be quite bold.
Yeah.
But boldness can push up against potential like retaliatory tactics by competitors or what is permissible.
I find it really funny that in Canada we have such a competitive mindset because it's such a small community in such a few cities that are so dense.
Yeah.
And we should all be friends in some way. But then there's this macro critique of like the state of our social capitalism in this country, you know, and like how friendly are Canadians with each other? And is that the same as it's always been? Or is that something that's, you know, changing?
I feel like it's changing.
You do?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the influence of America on Canada, and I think it's absolutely changing the fabric of Canada in terms of what is considered acceptable to say in public, right? Be that gender-based discrimination, racism, there is just, I feel like things are changing. Even our relationship to guns is changing here in Canada. But I think it's through the exposure of what's happening in the U.S.
Right.
Even like Pierre Poilievre's recent sort of commentary in the House, you know, name calling Trudeau. And I'm not advocating any one position. I'm just sort of saying, fascinating that that is happening, that sort of theatrical political display in Canada. But I think it is influenced by what's happening south of the border.
It's so crazy. So to unpack this a little bit for our international audience that, you know, aren't familiar with these names, essentially in Canada, you know, we have a parliamentary system modeled after England. This means that the parliamentarians, our government representatives that are, you know, also belonging to political parties, kind of stand up in this, you know, house on TV and they kind of like yell at each other for an hour, and they call that, you know, like question period, where each side asks each other questions. And like historically, it could have been like set up as a forum for dialogue, right, where these political representatives might not have a means of sitting down in behind closed doors. And part of this is, I think, to offer the public the ability to see behind the curtain and know that there's transparency in political process. But yeah, what it's devolved into in the last few years is just shouting matches. And you kind of hope that the government that's representative of the people would be able to get along, would be able to solve problems, and would be able to actually represent the will of the people, which is to make our lives better,
yeah,
and represent the collective. But yeah, you're right. You tune in and you see the leader of the opposition, who this guy is, conservative, right? Kind of playing this role that's like, hey, I'm a big tough guy too, and I'm going to yell at you and manhandle you. And not presenting opposing view that's based in political mandate or based in, you know, thought, but just like you said, name calling.
Yeah,
which is just a little bit silly.
Yeah, and because these behaviors get normalized, kind of drawing this parallel to social media.
Yeah.
So among our kids, behaviors get normalized based on what they see.
Right.
And so if there's, you know, desires or aspirations for fame, or for, you know, extreme commentary or extreme behavior,
mm-hmm.
it sets people up to say, okay, like in a Pavlovian kind of model,
right.
That is like, I will do this every time the bell rings, right? Or every time I get a like button or a heart, you know, that kind of thing. I find the same thing is happening in politics, but it's changing the nature of Canadian society,
mm-hmm.
which is there still an emphasis on civility and dialogue, you know, and really doing what's in the best interests of the country, or is it about political preservation?
Mm. Yeah, it's really curious. I think like the algos have messed everyone up. People try and game the algos, no matter if they're politicians or business people, right? And the algos themselves are not really calculated to be either open or destination based, particularly. There's a whole bunch of conditional logic, you know, that's totally irrational at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and that is driving human behavior now. And
totally.
It's curious, to say the least.
But it comes back to what we were just talking about a minute ago, which is, what are you trying to optimize for?
Sure.
Right. In your decision making changes, if you're optimizing for one variable only, mm-hmm. which is profit or likes, or, you know, something along those lines. It's very different when you start out by saying, what do I care about? What am I really trying to accomplish here? Is it about money alone? If it's not, how do I create or train an algo to optimize for multiple factors? And it's analogous to a B Corp versus a C Corp.
Yeah.
Right? In a traditional C Corp in the US, you are mandated to optimize for shareholder value, or to maximize shareholder value. So which then gives you the foil to say, so long as I'm making money for people, it doesn't matter if I pollute, especially if the penalty associated with pollution is nominal compared to the amount of profit that I can generate.
Right.
Right. Making a decision in the interests of the community or the environment is actually in opposition to your mandate around maximizing shareholder value.
Right.
So it's optimization for single variable only. With the B Corp structure that exists in Canada and the US and multiple places around the world,
mm-hmm.
it's about optimizing for stakeholder value. So then you say, okay, well, it's about money. It's about the community. It's about my employees. It's about the environment. And so I no longer need to go single variable only. Now I can optimize for multiple variables, and it changes the outcome.
It does. Yeah, and it also forces companies, yeah, to take this kind of, or the operators of companies, to take a step back to say, a company fits in an ecosystem.
Yes.
You know, it's not just about transactions. It's really interesting because the shareholder value question doesn't necessarily, or what we're seeing in the last few years, it doesn't necessarily lend itself to developing vision amongst employees. Everyone's thinking within a quarterly cycle, a reporting cycle. And what we've seen, of course, across the board in enterprise in Canada, post-pandemic, is CFO's office is driving so many decisions that pre-pandemic were out of a COO or CEO's office. And things don't necessarily get decided on that could impact a business 2 or 3 or 4 quarters or 10 quarters down the line and improve the lives of people working in a company, let alone other stakeholders, because they don't make sense now financially. They cost more money than we budgeted for. Well, when you made that budget, you weren't taking into account so many things. Yeah, and it does mean, I think, that type of behavior, this kind of C-Corp mentality in smaller companies especially, who are emulating the big boys, they're selling themselves short. And, you know, ultimately the consumers aren't winning. And the whole economy becomes less sustainable.
So I find this whole thing just fascinating. Because, well, I'll use the example of, let's say, the U.S., Canada, and Singapore, right? So the U.S. is older than Canada, right? Canada's, what, about 165 or something years old. Singapore is 60 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting, and then take European cities, which are even older. And within these European cities, or even Egypt, you know, you're adding, bolting on infrastructure to this ancient civilization.
Right.
So you have narrow little lanes that a horse and buggy mm-hmm. maybe can go down, and it coexists with super highways.
Yeah.
Right? Now, it's just interesting because when you have a relatively new country like Canada, the road system is actually pretty phenomenal. Like, our infrastructure is pretty great. There's at least 2-lane roads everywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? If not multi-lane highways. And so it's this notion that you get to build on the examples of the nations that came before you, right? And so in Europe, if your civilization was designed around walking or horses, that's the way that it is. In Canada, you know, cars were sort of more normal, and so that's the way our city is designed. In Singapore, it's only 60 years old. Their bureaucrats and their politicians are one of the most highly regarded positions in society. I believe they make something like $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an aspirational path to go,
right,
versus in Canada or the U.S. It's questionable.
Yeah.
Right?
The only reason people want a government job is for the security of never being able to be fired. In Canada,
there's an absolute notable driver.
And also, let's say something else. The government sector across the board in Canada, from municipal to federal, is, at least for the most recent numbers, like Q1 2024, the largest per capita employer in the country.
So, the interesting parallel to the B Corp, C Corp thing is, yeah, in Singapore, with the country only being 60 years old, they were able to learn how did other nations approach politics, democracy, infrastructure, housing, you know, pollution, car ownership, all of these things. They studied them and tried to create principles and laws that built or stood on the shoulders of all that came before. I hope that we're able to achieve something similar,
right,
with capitalism here, with community driven brands, where it's not just about money alone.
Yeah.
Right. But we can actually take a step back and say, how is this helping and how is it hurting?
Mm-hmm.
How do we architect something net new,
right,
that is better? And I hope, and these are the kinds of clients that we work with, which are brands and businesses that are trying to think differently and don't just want to follow the playbooks of everyone that came before them.
Yeah, and I think that that loads that word challenger so much, right? That we're in a challenging environment in a country set apart, you know, from the world in some ways. Definitely connected through our living links culturally with the rest of the world, but physically so set apart. And it's tough to export from Canada. We have, you know, government vehicles to help with that, but still. And so there's so many challenges to like starting big picture companies here in Canada. But at the same time, that's kind of exciting, you know, for people who like challenges, right?
Absolutely.
Let's take a pause on this Canada thing and okay. then we'll come back to your work a little bit. But like, what do you think Canada's brand is?
I think there's, it's a great question, one that I've been exposed to hundreds of times.
But the answer is always changing, right?
It is, but I believe there's a version of Canada that is about caring deeply about how we win.
Yeah.
And how we win includes who's present, right? So can we create an environment socially and economically where we can welcome immigrants and set them up to leverage all of their competencies?
Absolutely.
And so that's sort of one part of it, which I'll quickly address, which is like our immigration system is suboptimal because we welcome people in based on a point system. So which says that we value these things about you. Mm-hmm. We value that you are educated. We value that you come with a certain level of economics, that you have family ties. And then when they're here, it's like, by the way, you know that thing that we valued? That was on paper.
Right.
Right? Practically, your designations, whether it's as a doctor or engineer or a teacher or banker, you need to requalify, which is not always set up front. So I think that going back to this foundational point, I think it's about enabling everyone to win here, because mm-hmm. when we welcome people in, we enable them to capitalize on all of their competencies that we valued in the first place. So
right.
I think that's one aspect of Canada. I think a second is understanding that there's tremendous amount of value in diversity. So in this individual piece, it's like we welcome you and we enable you.
Yeah.
In the second piece, it's that we're better together, right? That we can learn a lot from one another, and that we can have better teams, better organizations because of that diversity. So in essence, we can become, we should become like the global headquarters for so many organizations because we're representative of the globe.
Totally.
So I think that's the second piece.
Yeah.
And then I think the third piece is this interesting relationship between social good and capital good,
mm-hmm.
and not looking at things myopically, but as a system. Another quick, just Singaporean example, which yep. I find fascinating. 98% of Singaporeans live in government housing, but it's not government housing in a derogatory way or a less than way that we would sure. otherwise think about. It's beautiful.
It's not a project.
Exactly. Now, the particular fascinating example is that to gain homeownership as a young person, it's made that much easier if you live close to your grandparents.
Hmm.
And it's because you can maintain that relationship and be helpful, which then lessens the burden on society. And I think that's the kind of systems thinking that we need here, which is Canada has a very, very strong social ethos
yeah.
and a more welcoming than historically economic base. But it's like, can we start to think about the relationship between these two, where it's not the social infrastructure of Canada is distinct from the capital infrastructure.
Right.
In fact, there's a relationship so that perhaps your property taxes are lower if you're in proximity to your grandparents or your parents, so that you can play a role in caring for them as they age, minimizing the social isolation and then the healthcare cost.
Sure.
Right. And so that's where I think the potential for Canada is mm-hmm. Enabling individuals, being better together as a community, but then integrating social and economics for policy that's just overall better.
Right. And I mean, let's face it, we're just 42 million people, mainly in what, 4 or 5 cities. It should be easier, hopefully, in the next few decades for Canadians to come together around these sorts of issues and work together to find solutions that, you know, harmonize equity. So that's definitely a hope for the near future. And then, okay, so one last thing on this is, I'm curious to know, is Canada a challenger brand? And if it is, where you see opportunity for Canada in the global context?
Yeah, I think it's definitively a challenger brand, yeah, particularly given our relative youth compared to most or many nations in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think the opportunity for Canada going forward is to demonstrate that winning isn't everything. It's about how you win. And so I think that is kind of the net point. We have in the South, we have a you know, our capital-driven neighbor has done extraordinary things for the world, both positively and negatively.
Sure.
Right. And I think we can demonstrate that we can take the best of America and combine it with the best of the world.
Yeah.
Because of all of these insights and intellect and drive from immigrants, and weave a tapestry that is materially stronger and healthier.
Okay, I totally agree with you on all those points. And I'm actually excited. Like, it's funny because especially coming out of the pandemic, there's a lot of like doom and gloom, especially in this room that we've heard on mic from a lot of people, because economics are tough right now. And of course, out of tough situations come, you know, brilliant creations that, you know, solve problems very well in ways that, you know, otherwise may not, like the diamond comes from pressure, right? But I wanted to also talk about tools, you know, like, yeah, marketing tools and how the landscape or the tool set may be changing. And if there's anything you can offer about that.
Yeah, I think... it sounds cliche to say it, even though it's early in the game, but yeah, AI is changing everything.
Yep.
And the extent to which marketing firms are still around 10 years from now or even 5 years from now, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And if there will be, they're going to be in materially, there's going to be a material level of attrition. So I think the principal tool is how do folks leverage AI to create something that they might otherwise have defaulted to outsourcing for, either by hiring an expert or hiring an agency.
Sure.
And just considering what can they do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the main thing. And it is, at least our experience is that it's an extraordinary first draft.
Right.
Unbelievable. Not finished product.
No.
But first draft.
You can demonstrate conceptualization really quickly. You can prototype ideas.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think many marketers, one of their superpowers is being able to do pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they either do pattern recognition among consumers where they're trying to figure out what are my customers' unmet needs, right? What are their expectations of me? So that's one, but also the pattern recognition of what enables those successful brands to be successful.
Yeah.
ChatGPT or many of these AI tools can help accomplish that, right? By saying, here are the URLs of 10 companies, or let me input 10 ads, help me understand what do they have in common, what's enabling them to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that level of insight, which would otherwise be reserved for someone that is curious and has decades of experience, can now be brought into the hands of just about everyone.
Or if nothing else, the analysis on data that then you could provide your own, you know, insights from. It's really interesting because, you know, I think up until recently, there were certain types of businesses that reserved that function in society because they could pay for it in a way. You know, like law firms, for example, are a great example of, on one hand, you've got law firms or people who are in law saying, wow, like if you're about to graduate, you know, from law, from university, and you're wondering, oh my God, will I get hired as an articling student because now software can do that job? There's a lot of fear. And then on the other side, the operator of the firm is thinking, well, we can triage a lot of the way that we kind of do these roles using software. But then that's kind of cool because those people could come in like superpower their position, and that's not 3-4 years of getting up to speed now as a new entrant into a firm. It could be like 6 months.
For sure. It feels like having a sous chef.
Yeah, that's it. Just extra hands.
Yeah, and it's prep. Like if the prep enables you to work your magic more efficiently.
Right.
Amazing. I'm just not sure how many years of that we have.
Right.
I think we may be in a period where, yes, AI is a sous chef, and in short order, it could be the chef.
Yeah, it could be the chef. Especially as like, I have my own thoughts on this, and I want to hear your perspective on kind of like our over-reliance on programmatic and the question of efficacy even with programmatic and how that might play into AI in the next few years.
Yeah, it's confusing to me, to be honest. I don't have a strong point of view on it because it's changing so rapidly.
It really is, yeah.
We rely on the algos from the service providers. So whether it be Meta or TikTok or whatever, we're relying on them without the transparency to understand, you know, how do we make it that much more effective?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard. I don't know how to achieve exponentially better results without understanding how the machine is built.
Yeah.
And if we go back to a previous comment, and I'm sorry if this is like so much of our conversation is quite philosophical, but going back to one of our earlier points, if the optimization is for profit alone,
right,
and not multiple characteristics,
yeah,
I don't know what the consequences of my actions are, or like my programming specs.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, you know, Facebook is aware or Meta is aware of the impact on younger people and teens, it's also a revenue driver.
Yeah, it's very confusing because there's all these mixed messages, even with like Google's helpful content updates in the last little while for search engine optimization. They're saying, well, and even what Sundar has been saying, you know, recently on many microphone sessions in the last few months is that SEO is dead. If you're in SEO, go get a different job. Part of that story is, you know, AI tools will help people structure content better to be indexed. Part of it is the index is going to become redundant because different interfaces for knowledge are going to become available in the next few years for consumers. So finding answers to questions won't necessarily be reliant on websites anymore is the posit. Another reason, of course, is that their own means of delivering ads to people is tenuous. And I think that is the biggest kind of interesting thing is that the web, as we've known it for 20 years, has been built on Google. And particularly, I mean, all the walled gardens additional to that, the private social networks and so on. But if advertisers, through programmatically, you know, putting in budget to this kind of, so if advertisers are buying creative that's purposefully drafted to perform on these advertising networks because the networks guarantee access to a customer. And that access now is totally becoming like questionable. So the cost of targeting those people is going up. You never know if that cost is efficient. You're constantly experimenting because you're trying, okay, and let's face it, all these experiments are not to see how best to reach the customer. It's how best to use the platform to reach the customer. I think the whole promise of programmatic has always been a little bit, you know, murky. And otherwise, like I had this thought this morning, I was like ruminating on this, right? So like the classic startup kind of marketing playbook is like, get more money from your VCs to put in a marketing, prove your cost of user acquisition, figure out retention later, but get those customers in the door using ads, and ads is something that you can spend on. But that's a great fallacy because otherwise, I mean, like everyone, as long as like limitless budget, look at any XYZ company, unicorn, limitless budget, were they able to own the market? Again, like you said, you know, C-Corp styles, they might own the market by pouring more money than is even working into the ad platforms. And then they're not cash flow sustainable because they can't keep buying those new customers to manage the attrition.
I know. It's
so tricky. It's very tricky. But I personally think the counterbalance is in brand. And I don't know, I don't have answers in how brands can, in the next 5-10 years, do a better job of, you know, strengthening relationships with stakeholders. But I do look at all this media capability that's being fueled by AI and the access to creativity as being quite exciting. Quite exciting, because companies can be more expressive.
I think where things are going to change, which is extraordinary, is in the depth of the relationship and the affordability in achieving that depth.
Yeah.
So let's say that you're a customer of Nike and your passion was tennis. Great. You'll see a bunch of tennis content because of the preferences that you've identified, you know, your viewing habits, your feedback based on the tennis-based ads that they send you.
Right.
But if your passion area was doubles, just as an argument's sake, or for argument's sake, the ability for them to create content for you and the small number of people relatively that are passionate about doubles by using AI is mind-boggling. So I think what we'll start to see is the filtering, like a dramatic filtering to get content that you want that's relevant for you on the timeline that you want it.
Yeah.
But a company's ability to deliver that for marginal incremental cost rather than them saying, we need to prioritize. We can only address these 3 or 4 markets and everyone else will have to deal, or we'll have big buckets or big sort of containers for customers. Now I think we'll migrate towards the one-of-one type marketing.
That's interesting. I like it.
And then I think the other piece that plays out is around relationship, which is why do you give a shit about doubles tennis? Like, right. What is it? Was it because of the relationship you had playing doubles with your father or something like this? The extent to which they're able to engage in a relationship with you and identify or see the patterns that, oh, you seem to engage in a lot of like father-son content and doubles content. You know, we can start to match those things up and connect you with other people that have the same sort of interests, or teach you how you can have, you know, that like use doubles as a means of bonding with your daughter, right? And and encourage sort of like tickets or lessons or whatever it happens to be.
It's funny because it's like, it's the holy grail, you know, in a way of marketing, but at the same time of like human nature, which is like people don't want to know themselves, right? And ultimately, if they have no self to get to know, they're faced with a great, you know, existential crisis. Everyone cannot be a Buddhist. It will crush them. It would crush their selves. But like, I find that it's so funny because, you know, as the algos become a little bit more personalized and a little bit more deep in the amount of knowledge they're crunching about people, I think we're also dancing on this precipice of disaster where, you know, the kind of digital profile doesn't necessarily match up with human wants and desires if people are being realistic and honest with themselves, for themselves. And it may continue to perpetuate false narratives of people's identities, which we see through, you know, Instagram, selfie, egomania.
Totally. Right? All of this stuff is unbelievably scary and has massive consequences. And there's some aspects that are really beautiful and that could deliver value. So not to beat a dead horse, but if we come back to these organizations that we're entrusting with our data,
right?
What are they optimizing for? Is it profit alone? I think be worried, right? Be worried, because if there's no code of conduct, there's no values or principles that are driving enough, or how far is too far,
right?
There's the potential for real pain and consequence. If, however, we start to back or engage with brands that we trust, that have principles, enduring principles, not do no evil, and then, well, maybe a bit of evil is okay. Like, not the evolution of your core principle, but an adherence to your core principle. I think we have the opportunity to leverage these tools to create something better.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it.